Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. Tragedy struck on Saturday, September 15th, when 26-year-old Arthur Medici from Revere was fatally bitten by a white shark off Newcomb Hollow Beach in Wellfleet. Medici was the first shark bite fatality in Massachusetts since 1936, but the second person this summer to be bitten. On August 15th, William Lighton from New York was bitten while swimming at Longnook Beach in Truro. Today, we look at the safety, economic, and natural resource management repercussions from the shark bite fatality. The week before the fatal shark attack, our reporter Stephanie Geyer-Stevens was at Nauset Beach and spoke with Kenyon Massey, who's been surfing on the Cape for 14 years. When she spoke with him, there had already been the earlier shark bite in mid-August, followed by on and off beach closures from Eastham to Truro caused by more shark sightings. Here's Stephanie's report.
So we're at Nauset Beach in Orleans. My mom would bring me here after school in high school and get to surf and relax. But yeah, there's some fabulous waves that come through here. I love water. I love being in water. I love the weightlessness. I love just feeling surrounded, because our waves here are so steep that you really have to lean into the wave, and so there's this weightless feeling, and it's very minimal movement. It's not at all aggressive. It's not forcing anything. It's it becomes this really delicate dance on this massive, powerful chunk of water. Right here at this beach, there were surfers and swimmers out in the water, and a shark came up and grabbed a seal amongst all those people. I'd be lying if I said I wasn't at all nervous. You know, I've known they were out here. I've seen one before. But it also seems to be, you know, somewhat common knowledge that it seems like, at least for the sharks on the Cape, that if there are attacks, that they're mistaking us for seals. You know, we just try to use common sense and caution, and certainly not tempt the sharks in any way. You know, I would definitely keep my distance if I saw one. I wouldn't test my luck for it at all. I probably think about it every time I go out. And, you know, I look around, see if I can see anything. And I've definitely psyched myself out if I've fallen in the water and I lose my board or something. And I'll think, you know, try to get back on as quickly as possible. But it's definitely there, which I think is good. It's good to be mindful, just as long as, yeah, you're not bringing too much aggression or fear into the scenario. It certainly isn't going to keep me out of the water, and if it were to happen, you know, there's not much I could do. You know, the shark's going to outswim me. The shark's going to is much more adept in the water, and surfing is definitely my favorite thing on earth to do. So if I get eaten by a shark doing it, then I can make peace with that.
A week after Kenyon spoke with WCAI's Stephanie Geyer-Stevens, Arthur Medici was boogie boarding at the same beach and was fatally bitten by a shark. We thought a good place to begin our conversation with Kenyon Massey, who joins us now on the phone. Good morning, Kenyon.
Good morning.
So what were your first thoughts when you heard about the shark bite fatality at Nauset Beach?
He was in Wellfleet, correct?
Yeah, right. I'm sorry. Yeah, go ahead. What were your thoughts when you heard about it?
Well, I was very sad to hear about it. I really felt for his family. It definitely brings it all into reality. I think we all were aware that this could happen, and people are just being a little bit more vigilant about it.
Yeah. Have you been out surfing since then?
I have, yes.
Mm-hmm. Has it changed your perception of the risk in the water?
A lot of the local surfers surf through the winter, and so just the natural elements are always a risk. So we're aware that that it is dangerous, but that part hasn't really changed that much.
Mm-hmm. So are there protocols or guidelines that surfers follow that might decrease your risk of attack?
Well, we all, mostly people use leashes, and we've talked about this before. before these attacks this summer that we could use the leashes as tourniquets. You know, we try to go out with other surfers, and we're mostly looking out for each other. So it was just discussed beforehand. There hasn't been any official protocols, and we don't have other types of official tourniquets, right. But
So what are you hearing from fellow surfers about the attack and how it's impacted them? Do they pretty much share your same view?
I think a lot of people do. I have heard some people have stopped surfing at least until the wintertime, until the sharks aren't around as much. I spoke with my friend Eileen Varner yesterday, who said that another mutual friend of ours was surfing and a shark circled him and bumped his board. So there have been interactions where surfers have not been harmed.
Right. Kenya Massey, thanks so much for talking with us and sharing your thoughts. We appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me.
And joining us in studio now, Greg Scomo, biologist and shark expert at the Massachusetts Department of Marine Fisheries. Welcome back, Greg.
Good to be here.
Brian Karlstrom, superintendent of the Cape Cod National Seashore. Good morning, Brian.
Good morning, Minnie.
Leslie Reynolds, chief ranger at the Cape Cod National Seashore. Good morning, Leslie.
Good morning.
And with us also is Wendy Northcross, president of the Cape Cod Chamber of Commerce. Morning, Wendy.
Good morning.
Greg, I'm going to start with you for a second because he mentioned in his talking about the waves, and it's a very popular area for surfers because the waves are so good. But that also kind of impacts the talk a little bit about those troughs and how the sharks have kind of figured out to get a little bit closer to the seals.
Well, I think what you need to do is take a broad look at what the strategy is here for the sharks. The sharks are here to attack and kill the seals and eat them, and it's a simple predator prey relationship. And the seals basically figure out that the sharks are out there, and they stay fairly close to shore, particularly as we get into August, September, October. And so the sharks are doing anything they can in utilizing troughs and moving around sandbars and looking for ways to get access to the beach. And unfortunately, this can create situations where the sharks are actually very, very close to shore. And something I've been saying repeatedly for the last few weeks is we can't think in terms of distance from shore anymore. We need to think in terms of water depth. If the sharks have access to water in excess of 5-6 feet deep, they're going to go in there to try to ambush these seals. And unfortunately, there's water users in these same areas.
Yeah. Brian, and I'm sure, you know, there's a lot of people who are thinking, you know, well, you're going far out. That's when you have to worry about it. And, you know, Arthur Medici was, you know, boogie boarding, where you would think maybe not quite as dangerous as being out a little bit farther surfing. But what was your thinking about safety at the National Seashore once this happened? I mean, this is something we thought, okay, the sharks are here. At some point, we may see a fatality, and now it's here. Does that change anything?
We've had the same messaging in place for over 5 years at the National Seashore, informing the visitors that come, and it's very consistent up and down the entire Cape from the work that's been done through the Shark Working Group, which Greg and Leslie are both part of and have helped to inform that. And we're going to continue with that messaging. You know, it's an undeniably huge tragedy that Arthur was fatally injured through that shark attack, and the community is still in a sense of mourning and recovery from that. And honestly, in a lot of ways, we're never going to recover, because that fatality resulting from a shark incident is a game changer for all of us that elevates the level of awareness for the entire community. And we're really talking about visitor behavior changing. The sharks and the marine environment are part of that wild environment. And as Greg said, they're there to hunt the seals. Mm-hmm. That's a very simple predator-prey relationship that is continuing to evolve. The distinction at Cape Cod from other places around the world is we've got a heavy recreational use interface happening in the same proximity. And that's a real challenge for all of us that we're going to continue to work on together, come up with the best awareness and information we can for the visiting public. Because it's an amazing place to visit and experience, and now sharks and seals interacting are a part of that.
Yeah. And as you're mentioning, Region has been proactive about white shark-human interactions since they were first spotted in greater numbers. The working group was formed to increase public safety and education. So, Leslie, you and Greg both have been part of that group, working group. So describe some of the initiatives the working group has implemented or has been talking about.
So the working group was formed in 2012, and we've worked very hard using science to inform our public safety decisions. We've worked hard educating ourselves and the public on how to stay shark safe, and we've done this through signage and brochures and a shark safety video, Sharktivity app. We use the purple flag with the white shark silhouette. We do a lot of press releases, a lot of interviews. We try to get the message out. We've, in 2016, we actually held a shark safety presentation at the seashore where Dr. Scommel spoke, a lifeguard spoke, an ER doctor spoke about if you do get bitten and you have a traumatic injury, this is how you stop the bleeding. So we've come from, oh, there's sharks in the water, to if you get bit by a shark, this is what you can do to stop the bleeding. So we meet intermittently throughout the year. We have a consistent group that meets, but it's open to other emergency services in other towns and other organizations. And we want to keep our minds open. There may be something new. Somebody may have a great idea. We don't want to rest on our laurels, so to speak. And we just want to keep using science to inform our decisions to keep the public safe.
Yeah, Wendy, from the perspective of businesses that rely on tourism and a seasonal economy, what are the concerns about the long-term impacts of this? And what have you been hearing? I mean, I know before the fatality, you get people calling you, like, where can I see the sharks?
Right.
And since then, you've got some different kinds of phone calls.
Well, it's still been a huge curiosity, you know, and I've always likened it to people like to look at car wrecks and train wrecks, and I guess they're looking for, you know, the sharks because they can imagine what might happen. But we always knew that the shark issue was real and could have impact on tourism. And I remember talking to Greg years ago, I think it was about 10 years ago, when the great whites came back. And Greg was pretty upfront with me back then about, Wendy, it's a matter of when, not if, there'll be shark-human interaction that's not going to go well. And so for years we've been, you know, longer than 2012, we've been communicating with people that there are sharks out there, holding my breath for the first few years because businesses automatically thought sharks meant business would go away. And then they found it was quite the opposite. But now we're kind of in new uncharted territory. So I'm now having more reaction from our members than I am from the general public. And things like, you have to tell them there's no sharks in our water here in this community, but there are sharks over there. And, you know, so it's becoming a very interesting conversation. We've been watching it closely because I don't know what to expect. The question to me is, will this impact tourism? And I'm guessing yes, but I've never been in this situation before. Cape Cod's never actually been in this exact situation before. So it's hard to imagine. It's hard to guess. And I won't guess, but I will, and we don't have to do it now, but I will share with you some of the comments that we've been getting from the general public, not out of fear, but out of solution offering and more of a media frenzy than a consumer concern. So I do think that there's a lot of lessons we're learning at this point in time. People aren't as afraid as we thought they might have been or should be.
Yeah. So Greg, this member saying, all right, tell them the sharks aren't in my water over here, but they're in the water over there. Can you do that? Can you say where the sharks will be?
Well, you know, I'm never going to stick my neck out so far as to be able to say that a white shark won't show up in any particular area because they move, you know, and they're all over the state. But one thing we've tried to do with our research the last several years is expand our acoustic receiver array throughout all of Massachusetts waters, and that gives us a relative sense of where the sharks spend the bulk of their time. And working with individual towns all the way from Cape Ann to New Bedford, we now know, we have a sense of what areas are relatively devoid of sharks for most of the summer, and those areas which are the hot spots. And as you can imagine, the hot spots include the Outer Cape as well as parts of the Inner Cape from Provincetown down to Wellfleet. And then the abundance of sharks diminishes as you move west and north up to the North Shore. And then as we look at south of the Cape, we see that the number of acoustic detections of our tagged sharks is really, really low in Nantucket, Vineyard Sounds, and Buzzards Bay during the summer months. And I believe that's driven by water temperature. But as things begin to cool off in September, October, we see the sharks start to move into those areas, but in very, very low numbers.
Right. So beaches have been closed to swimming when sharks are sighted, but how enforceable is that? We saw that even after the fatality, people were back in the water the next day. Leslie?
Well, I can speak to the National Seashore. When our lifeguards are on duty from the third Thursday in June through Labor Day, we have a shark attack and incident protocol. So if a shark is observed within the lifeguarded beach area up to 500 yards out, we will actually pull everybody out of the water for 1 hour. And there's not much enforcement that has to be done. People get out of the water and they turn and look into the water to see if they can see a shark. So every time we see a shark, we pull people out for an hour. Once the lifeguards are off duty about 5:30 or it's after Labor Day, then we change our signage to indicate lifeguards aren't on duty, to be shark smart. And we list all of the stay close to shore, waist deep, thigh deep, whatever your risk judgment is entering the water. And at that point, you can't keep people out of the water. There's no one there to manage it. Mm-hmm. But ultimately, nobody is going to be able to mitigate all the risk if you choose to recreate in the ocean. You can be safe and stay out of the water, but if you choose to go in, we can educate, we can use science, we can put up signs, we can put lifeguards there. But if you still choose to go into the water, that's a risk that you as a person are willing to take.
Okay. So Mindy, yeah. Interestingly, my early research on this, 77% of the people that go to the beach don't go in the water.
Oh, really?
Just in general.
Wow. Mm-hmm. All right. So this waist deep, Greg, will you go beyond waist deep in the water swimming?
Well, I think in certain parts of the Cape, particularly the outer Cape, waist deep is a very good guideline.
866-999-4626 is our number if you'd like to join our conversation this morning. 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We are talking about sharks this morning with Greg Skolmel, biologist and shark expert at the Massachusetts Department of Marine Fisheries, Brian Carlstrom, superintendent of the Cape Cod National Seashore, Leslie Reynolds, chief ranger at the Cape Cod National Seashore, and Wendy Northcross, president of the Cape Cod Chamber of Commerce. 866-999-4626 is our number if you have a comment or a question for us. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. One of the problems we saw with the two shark attacks that we had summer, it was cell phone reception. There's areas where there, you know, it was difficult to call for help. So that's an area I think we've been having some conversations on as to how to remedy that. What are we thinking? Leslie, do you have any ideas on that?
Well, I would love to see better cell phone connectivity out on the beaches. And that's a great discussion that we'll be having as part of the shark work group. And I know talking to Brian, he's going to have a discussion with town managers across the Cape and maybe some legislators. We'll get into that conversation. Right now, the seashore, we use cell phones, satellite phones, and radios to communicate any emergencies on our beaches. Mm-hmm. But it's challenging.
Yeah.
The Open Cape Corporation, which is the private public partnership with federal money to build the new backbone on the Cape for broadband, high-speed broadband. They've had some concepts that they've thrown out there, and I think they have a willingness to work with the Outer Cape communities to kind of strengthen that network and do it in a way where there are not ugly cell phone towers, mm-hmm. but they're just you create a more robust network out yeah. there.
Greg, you've been studying the white shark for a number of years now. Are you seeing changes in the way they're moving along the coast, or that might change their feeding habits? Or what are you learning? I mean, you mentioned that we've got these, we can see where they are throughout Massachusetts waters, but what else are we learning?
Well, we're using a number of technologies and have been for several years to get a sense of their local movements around the Cape, as I indicated earlier. And you know, when there are a handful of sharks, and we started doing this in 2009, they seem to, for the most part, be located off of the southern part of the Outer Cape, so Monomoy Island, Chatham, and that was our hot spot. But as numbers have increased, and that is something that is happening, we are seeing that in our data set. We've cataloged over 300 individual white sharks in these waters, and in the coming months we'll come up with an estimate of the total population size, and which I think everyone will be interested in. But as more sharks come to these areas, they tend to spread out. They tend to find their own space, they're located all along the Outer Cape as well as inside Cape Cod Bay and really throughout the state. And what I'm most concerned with is as you increase densities of these animals, a competition can develop between individuals where food resources, particularly seals that are piled very close to the beach, are a hot commodity that they're trying to go for, and they become somewhat competitive for these resources, and that can provide challenges.
Yeah. There was some pretty dramatic video of you this summer where you were out and the shark just jumped right out of the water, which it just seemed crazy. Was that unusual behavior? I mean, it seemed like something right out of the movies.
Well, I'm happy to say it's unusual behavior. If that happened to me every day, I'd probably go cut lawns because, that was really strange, this breaching behavior. We've only seen breaches probably three times in the last 10 years, and usually they're some attempt to capture prey. So in this case, I think this shark was either spooked by the vessel or actively saw my image on the surface and was going after it. So it was a high anxiety moment for me.
What about their intelligence? Are they maybe smarter than we think they are?
Well, I think it's tough for us to measure intelligence in fish, but I think it's safe to say they're capable of learning. And it has been shown, when these sharks start becoming active predators on seals, they get better at it over time, and they're able to discern seals much better and know when the optimal conditions are for hunting. And that's been demonstrated in South Africa as well as in California, where these sharks get better at it. But you can imagine when they first show up on the scene, they're a shark that's never consumed a seal before and it has to figure out how to do that. I think it's those animals I'm concerned with.
Yeah. Leslie, you wanted to add something?
I was going to add that some of my staff from the beaches this summer, the rangers and the lifeguards, actually saw sharks breaching from shore.
Wow. Yeah. All right, let's talk to Dan, who's giving us a call from Mashpee. Hi, Dan.
Hi, how you doing?
Good.
I just wanted to say that I think it's time that we just, you know, have to take a more realistic approach. And if there are great white sharks around eating people, then we have to remove the seals that they hunt. And if that doesn't work, we have to remove the sharks. That's about it.
Okay, Brian, you want to take that one?
Yeah, Dan, I appreciate that observation, and it does seem pretty obvious. However, there are a couple of very powerful federal laws in place that prohibit us from doing that immediately, specifically the Marine Mammal Protection Act for the seals, and there's several other laws in place that protect sharks. And unless those change from the park's perspective, we're going to continue managing the seal and the shark populations as they naturally fluctuate, and continuing to inform the public as to the risks that they're taking whenever they go in the ocean.
And there's a lot of research going on with the seal population. I don't know, Greg, how familiar you are with it, but, you know, they were hunted and now they've returned. So there at some point there's some sort of leveling off, right? I mean, these are seals that are coming and going too, right? They're not here year-round.
Yeah, I mean, we hear a lot about the potential for seal culling. And, you know, I as far as all options, I mean, it's worth having these discussions and we really need to think about the feasibility of it. When you look at the seal population, we tend to think of 10, 20, 30,000 animals that can be removed. And what we need to think about is it's actually on the order of about 500,000 throughout the Northwest Atlantic, and they're all moving between sites. So you may take 10 or 20,000 seals from Cape Cod, and they'll be replaced very quickly by the others from other parts of the population. So, and then there's the feasibility of actually doing it. And as Brian suggested, there are laws in place that prohibit it. But, you know, it's something that needs to be really thought out. It's nice to throw these ideas out there, but you really need to think about how you actually go about doing it.
All right, Dan, thanks for the phone call. Bob is calling from Brewster. Hi, Bob.
Good morning, Mindy. I have a question. I'm a drone pilot, and I've been flying drones for about 5 years. And we've been prevented from doing any flying off of the National Seashore beaches. I wonder if there will be any more flexibility in giving us an opportunity to do some close observation of the waters off those beaches from our drones. I can say up for at least 30 minutes at a time, and I have three batteries, so I could help for 90 minutes in observing various seashore locations. Is there going to be any more flexibility so that we can help?
Yeah, that's an excellent suggestion, Bob. Drone technology continues to evolve, and the types of sensors you can have on those drones is the technology is very impressive and could be part of a solution. But like Greg said earlier, we've got to think out how we're going to implement this very carefully. The reason that drones are so prohibited within the seashore itself is we want to make sure that they're being utilized for very specific research purposes and not a recreational activity unto themselves. You know, drone technology could have a very significant role with monitoring sharks and seals, and they are currently used for monitoring the seal populations under very specific permitting conditions that we approve on up through the national level within the National Park Service.
Bob, thanks for the phone call. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. All right, Wendy, you've been getting calls about solutions. What are some of the things have been saying to you?
Surprisingly, not a lot of the call to call. Mm-hmm. Technology-related solutions, certainly drones have been suggested, submarine nets along the surfing breaks. There are wetsuits, supposedly, that will repel sharks. There are buoys that can sensor a shark immediately and know a shark from something else and ping it to an app. Sonar, underwater noise that will reject the sharks. I'm not condoning any of this. I'm just listing some of the comments. And lifeguards beyond Labor Day, cell phone service, surfer kits. Make sure that any surfer has a certain medical equipment on them. You know, just very interesting, very thoughtful. In some cases, people say, I'm not really quite sure how this will work, but I had an idea. So we write it down and say, thank you. We'll add it to the list. I know I was in Australia twice in the last 3 years, and the conversation in Australia is we're taking our nets out. They don't tend to work. They cause additional problems. It's the shark's home. We need to respect that. I do think Australia is pretty progressive on a lot of fronts. So I think that we've had some time to look at this, but we're now, like I said, looking at the issue of sharks in a totally new way and have the attention of people in a totally new way. And I think we need to use this opportunity to continue to educate. Mm-hmm. I do believe that there can be a more robust education process, and perhaps we create some branding. You know, I look at it from a marketer standpoint. Perhaps there's branding and signage that we share all across the Cape. We ask every single chamber, no matter what town you're in, to put information in your guidebook, as we have. Put it on your website. Just consistently put, we call it ocean safety and not just pick on the sharks.
Right.
Because there are other things out there, too.
Right. What are your thoughts about that, Greg? I mean, sure, you probably get people going, hey, why don't we do, have the buoys that can tell us, when they're swimming here and put nets around certain beaches. And there's all kinds of suggestions.
Yeah. And I think it's important for us to realize that there are other parts of the world. And Wendy mentions Australia, but certainly South Africa and California. There are other parts of the world have been dealing with this issue for decades. Right. And I've repeatedly said there's no silver bullet here, and it all boils down to feasibility. Yes, all of these options could be tested and tried. They come at an expense, and perhaps that expense is too high given the success of some of these techniques. But everything from underwater detection technology and repellents certainly could be tried. But the Outer Cape is a particularly challenging environment. It's very dynamic. And sand is moving constantly. Houses are collapsing into the water. And the thought of keeping barriers out there could be very difficult. And these surf breaks are very powerful areas. And people are surfing them because of it. And imagine these, this environment and trying to keep structures in place. And I mean, it's just, again, it boils down to feasibility. And I think every option should certainly be on the table, but it should be talked about realistically.
All right. Dylan is giving us a call from Nantucket. Hi, Dylan.
Hi, guys. I had a question for the scientist. Are there any other environments that have orca whales living with white sharks?
Orcas are known predators.
Yeah, I've heard that they don't get along. Yeah.
Well, yeah, the orca is a known predator of the white shark, and there is actually some empirical data that indicates if an orca kills a white shark, the white sharks will actually leave the area for a period of time. This was actually demonstrated off South Africa last year. And we do have orcas off our coastline. They tend to remain offshore, and they tend to be incredibly rare. We've had just a handful of sightings the last decade. But, you know.
Can we get one?
that's going to be tough.
Yeah. My 11-year-old granddaughter immediately texted me the Saturday of the fatality and said, "Orcas and humans are the known predators for sharks. You need an orca pod." Mm.
Dylan, thanks for that call. Laura's calling from Brewster. Hi, Laura.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm just glad that you're addressing the seal issue. I feel sad that I feel like it's a typical American response that as soon as there's an issue with something, let's kill the seals. It's the seals. Let's cull the population. Where maybe perhaps because there are so many seals to eat, they are less attacked on humans because their food source is so plentiful.
Yeah.
So I'm glad that you spoke to that. And I'm just, you know, I'm just afraid that people might take things into their own hands and, you know, organize seal hunts or something because that's the way to protect the beaches from the sharks.
Yeah. Laura, thanks for the call. And as we said, there's laws against that, so yes. That hopefully that we won't see that. But, Greg, let's talk about that because she's saying if there's enough seals, maybe they're – do they – when they're attacking humans, they're looking for seals. That's what their preference is. Is it kind of a, I don't know what that is in the water, let me kind of just test it and taste it and see if I can eat it? Or is it like, God, I'm just, you know, what is, are they smart enough to tell the difference, I guess, between seals and humans?
Yeah, in general, yes, they can discern the differences. I think the story we heard at the beginning of this program with, you know, surfers watching sharks that kill seals right next to them demonstrates that. There are times when confusing information is coming into the shark and environmental conditions play a major role. Poor visibility in the water, for example, water depth, those kinds of things, a lot of surge. That all creates issues for the shark, and there may be times when the shark is not necessarily 100% sure. I think in the swimmer that was attacked in 2012, that was more of what we call a test bite. No, nobody wants to be test bitten, obviously, but that individual survived with relatively minor injuries. But in these last two cases, my opinion was a clear case of the shark striking, thinking it was a seal that it was going after.
Mm. And you're mentioning, like, in the beginning of the season, in June and July, we have new seals coming in who haven't quite figured out where the safer places might be, where the sharks are. And I would imagine same thing with the sharks. You have new sharks coming in that are kind of testing the territory, so to speak. But they learn as the season goes on. Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we have to keep in mind this is a massive open system. Sharks showing up, new sharks each year, same sharks who are seasoned veterans know what's going on, but newer sharks are trying to figure it out. And the seals as well. We have young seals. We have seals coming in from Canada. It's a very open system. And early in the season, some of the more naive seals find themselves prey very quickly, whereas by generally mid to late July, they stay very close to the shore. They move inside the harbors and inlets to protect themselves, and then the sharks have to adapt as well by moving in closer to shore.
Leslie?
I also want to talk about learning, and the shark work group since 2012 has been really reinforcing how to stay shark smart when you recreate in the water. And anecdotal evidence, my lifeguards tell me, throughout the years, throughout the summer, they'd have to blow their whistles to call people closer to shore multiple times on one beach a summer. Since 2014, our lifeguards have to blow the whistle a few times all summer long. So we have learned, the visiting public has learned, I have learned, our behavior at the beaches is changing. We're staying much closer to shore.
Mm. I think it's important for people to know that being bitten by a shark is 100% preventable.
Mm-hmm.
To think about that. And I also think it's important to know that the culling of a shark, of a seal population especially, I believe would create a greater backlash to Cape Cod and our reputation and create more conflict and more problems than what we're currently undergoing now.
Yeah. I'm nodding heads around the table.
I mean, I think that there are people like seals. They're still trying to figure out sharks, but they like seals. And I think that there's we need to use the best science and common sense. And really our role is to keep people safe.
Right. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. More after break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking about sharks with Greg Skomel, biologist and shark expert at the Master Department of Marine Fisheries, Brian Carlstrom, superintendent of the Cape Cod National Seashore, Leslie Reynolds, chief ranger at the Cape Cod National Seashore, and Wendy Northcross, president of the Cape Cod Chamber of Commerce. 866-999-4626 is our number if you'd like to chime in on our conversation this morning. 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. Max is calling from Tisbury. Hi, Max.
Hello. So I am an avid year-round surfer here on the Vineyard, and I have family scattered across the country, and they're always like, Jaws, sharks, blah, blah, blah. And I always tell them that I'm more concerned about getting in a car accident or a moped accident with someone on the way to the beach than I am worried about sharks in the water, because statistically that's a greater probability.
Mm-hmm.
And then my other point is when I was in university, I wrote a paper on how humans can mitigate interactions with white sharks. And I found a paper where they compared the visual cortex to the olfactory bulbs in dead white sharks to kind of quantify if they hunt more with scent or with their vision based on age. And it found that younger sharks have a proportionately larger visual cortex, whereas older sharks have a larger olfactory bulbs. So, like, older sharks hunt more with scent, whereas younger sharks hunt more with their eyes, which brought me a little peace of mind that if I was confused for a seal, it would probably be a younger shark.
Mm. Greg, do you need an assistant? It sounds like.
Yeah, Max, I might hire you as an intern. No, those are good points, and I think it's, we talk about, you know, some people like to talk about intelligence in sharks, but what Max is indicating is that much of the brain of the shark is dedicated towards sensory perception, with various senses outweighing others depending on the feeding behavior at ages and at sizes. So younger sharks are, for the most part, consumers of fish, and it's not until they get larger, meaning somewhere in the 9 to 10 foot range, that they adapt. They become better hunters of seals and other pinnipeds, as well as scavengers of whales. So, you know, we've got this shift that occurs over the life of the shark. So most of the sharks we see out there hunting seals are larger. Mm. You know, they're not the younger animals, and they're well adapted to finding seals, and of course they do so largely through smelling them.
Right. And Max brought up another point, Wendy, that you said before we even went on the air. You're more likely, the odds are you're more likely to get killed in a car accident.
Don't text and drive.
Yeah, exactly. All right, Steve is calling from Orleans. Hi, Steve.
Morning. I live on the bay in West Brewster, and I swim daily in East Dennis. On C Street Beach, I swim to the jetty and back, and I've had to get out of the water. I can't swim there anymore because there's a 8 foot great white shark that has taken up residence there.
Mm-hmm.
And I used to love the fact that I'd see the gulls circling and diving, and then I'd see a churn of water. And that would all come towards me. They seemed to be attracted to me as I was swimming, and they would, and I would see a bunch of striped bass go under me. But now I'm afraid I'll see something else go under me.
Yeah.
One day I went to go swimming there, and a fisherman was standing in the water, and he says, "I wouldn't go in there if I was you." And I said, "Why is that?" He said, "There's a great white shark right there." It was a very calm day, and right on cue, the fin came up, the dorsal, and we just watched it go back and forth like it was patrolling. And he was able to cast to it and hit it with his leader, his lead leader. And
I said, well, that's it.
Yeah. Well, Steve, that's probably a smart decision to be wary where you swim. And this is what we're hearing a lot of people say. We're seeing sharks where we've not seen them before, right?
Yeah.
And I think for a while there in the beginning when we first started seeing them, we were telling kayakers, well, you know, take the kayaks into Wellfleet Bay or, you know, some. And now we're actually seeing sharks in the bays as well, right?
Yeah, Cape Cod Bay has in particular gotten a lot of attention this past summer. We get a lot of reports from charter captains and private boat owners and swimmers that are telling us they're seeing more sharks in that area. So we're expanding our research efforts into that area next year.
All right. Whitney has said, please comment on the seal colony on No Man's Land, clearly visible on Google Maps, and its implication for Martha's Vineyard. How does this compare to the Outer Cape in Monomoy?
Well, I can only comment to the extent that I know it's out there, you can see it on Google Maps. We actually had a receiver out there, acoustic receiver, to see if it would detect any of our white sharks consistently, and we only had one hit on it from that one of our white sharks that was there in late June, and this is the year before last, when we expected there'd be quite a few sharks taking advantage of it. But a lot has to do with the ability of these sharks to get close to these seals, and they may not stay in an area that's particularly challenging. No Man's Island, several miles off the coast of the Vineyard, I'm not too concerned about how that seal colony is going to impact the Vineyard. I would be more concerned perhaps looking to the east toward Muskeget Island, which is fairly close, but we haven't had a lot of detections out at Muskeget either. So the sharks, again, seem to be consistently off the Outer Cape compared to other areas.
Jonathan writes, a predator-prey relationships aren't simple. There are mathematical models which attempt to get at the dynamic. The question is, in this case, what are the variables that promote balance or imbalance in the relationship that would lead to a drop in the shark population over time? That's a tough question.
No, but he's absolutely yeah. right. You know, I had a feeling somebody would catch me on that when I said it's a simple relationship, and I did boil it down to shark wanting to eat seal and seal not wanting to get eaten. Mm-hmm. But he's absolutely right, and these kinds of mathematical models are complex, and they have a lot of variables that are very difficult to solve. But he's right, and we can run those models once we get more data on it, but we need a lot more information before we can do that.
Right. Annetta is calling from Wellfleet. Good morning, Annetta.
Hello. I missed the whole beginning of the show, unfortunately, but I just was hoping that perhaps you've already spoken to this, but I know there's, our species is hopefully going to eventually become better stewards of our planet in general, but I'm just wondering if there's some kind of relationship between all of the problems that we're causing for the porpoises and whales and those species with all of our noise pollution from the shipping lanes and the drilling and mapping and all that stuff, if there's maybe some kind of relationship with, since we're changing those behaviors to an extreme amount, maybe there's some relationship with the sharks also, you know, mm-hmm. if we're changing all of their other behaviors, maybe somehow that's also changing.
Yeah. I guess it goes to it's a dynamic, always changing, right? As populations move, the other populations move, they follow the food.
Yeah, I mean, I think that what we need to do in this case is not overthink it too much. We have, with the passage of the Marine Mammal Protection Act, we have the restoration of seal populations, and we have the sharks' response to that. So the seals represent a robust resource for food. And they're coming back in numbers because they're being protected. So what we have here is what some would call, including myself, a conservation success story.
Mm-hmm. Martin is calling from Orleans. Hi, Martin.
Good morning. I'm curious if there are sharks in Pleasant Bay.
We have had a acoustic receivers in Pleasant Bay, and none of our tagged sharks have been in there. And I know we've had some recent reports, which I don't think are credible in terms of actual white shark sightings within the bay. So I don't believe they're in Pleasant Bay.
Thanks for the call. All right. So one of the things we were talking about is better maybe cell service, some kind of cell boxes or satellite phones, things to get better emergency response. What about training for lifeguards? As this has become an issue, Leslie, that's a question, is what's the lifeguard's role in this?
Right. One of my biggest fears is if a lifeguard were to be injured, and that keeps me up at night, seriously. So the National Seashore, we hire approximately 50 lifeguards each year, and they're professional lifeguards. The majority come back year after year after year, and they love what they do, and they love rescuing people. You know, over the course of 7 years, we've rescued 106 people from riptides, currents, and shore breaks, and assisted almost 1,000 people out of the water. So that is our number one bread and butter right there. But as far as the sharks, we have very well-written shark attack and incident response policy. The lifeguards train every day that they're employed with us how to put on a tourniquet, how to stop bleeding, how to rescue people out of the water. We have go-no-go situations. If this certain incident presents itself, the lifeguards need to be safe. They pull people out of, if somebody was to be bitten by a shark, everybody comes out of the water. The lifeguards, two or more, enter the water, either stand up paddleboard, or we bought some new shorty boards that they can get themselves up out of the water. We have medical equipment we can put over the person so there's no transfer of blood as much as possible. And it's a very real concern. Our lifeguards used to train going out from the beach and back, swimming, because they have to be in great shape. They have to swim. Somebody's life and their life may depend on that. Now I've asked them to swim horizontally. One of my head lifeguards, he'll actually swim and make sure his fingertips are touching the bottom of the water. So it's something we discuss every year, and it's something they train for every day.
Does in the working group, do they talk about that kind of training for, I mean, because some of the town beaches lifeguards, some just their high school kids a lot of times, what kind of training do they have?
Well, I don't work on the town beaches, but I do know that the lifeguards communicate, and I wish I could give you details on that, but a lot of times the town well fleets, they'll participate in our surf rescue school, which takes place over a weekend at the beginning of each summer, and that is a full 2 days of a swim run test and emergency response and drills, and we even, at two of our beaches, at least twice a week, we'll run an emergency drill so the public will see what we do. And we do that at Head of the Meadow Beach. And Head of the Meadow Beach that the seashore runs is right next to Head of the Meadow Beach for the town of Truro. So I know our two lifeguard programs really work well together there. But as far as what the towns are doing to train their lifeguards, I can't speak to that today.
In the last minute and a half we have, Greg, I just wanted to ask you, since we've been talking about sharks for many years now, and you're learning new things all the time, and when we first started talking about sharks maybe a decade ago, I don't even remember now, we didn't know a lot, and you would kind of say, well, this was a surprise, and that was, what are some of the surprises that you're learning now as you're tagging these sharks and learning more about where they go and what they do?
Well, I think that, you know, for me, it's looking at the finer scale information we're getting about the movements of these animals, and we don't have all our conclusions yet, but what's really emerging is individual behavior patterns that these sharks have. We have a number of individuals that come back each year and seem to have very consistent behavior in very specific areas. And so it's unique attributes that these animals have that surprised me, I think, the most. You know, we could say on average what the species is doing, but what's more appropriate is us to look at these individual behaviors. And the direction we're moving in, we hope to do this in the near future, is have actually forecast models and be able to predict likelihood of shark presence in certain parts of the Cape.
Yeah, and certainly we'll learn more as the working group continues their conversations and we figure out where we're going forward. Greg Skomel, biologist, shark expert at the Massachusetts Department of Marine Fisheries, Brian Carlstrom, superintendent of the Cape Cod National Seashore, Leslie Reynolds, chief ranger at the Cape Cod National Seashore, and Wendy Northcross, president of the Cape Cod Chamber of Commerce. Thank you all for being here this morning and talking with us. Appreciate your time.
Thanks, Mindy.
Thank you, Mindy.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thank you for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.